Right, today I'm in a pod at the top of the Vivo building, the home of the Racing Post, with Tom Kerr. Thanks for joining us today, Tom.
Pleasure.
We keep checking around to make sure we're not going to blow away with Hurricane Elena's remains buffering us, but anyway, we'll see how we go. Right, Tom, you seem to be the go-to journalist at the Racing Post for sort of stirring things up in the community. Are you not frightened of upsetting members of the racing elite, and are you happy with that role, if indeed that is your role?
Well, I never set out purposely to upset anyone. That's not why I do what I do. But as a journalist, my job is to cover stories which I think are relevant, thought-provoking, or just curious, frankly. And sometimes that does mean that issues get raised which some people would rather not be raised. But you know, I neither apologise for that nor revel in it. I'm not looking to annoy anyone. But if it takes annoying someone to raise a crucial issue, then that's my job, and I've got to do it.
Well, that job now is, as we all know, at the Racing Post. Can you tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into racing, and how you sort of arrived at where we are now?
Sure thing. Yeah. I grew up in Glasgow and don't really have a racing connection in the family, aside from remembering very distantly when I was a wee kid getting taken along a couple of times to the races by my grandfather. But I always bet in the Grand National. That was the one thing that I had every year. And I'd always, you know, wake up on Grand National Day and be really excited about the you know, the pin stickers pages in your paper, and going down and looking at all the exotic names and the colours and reading the star ratings, and eventually picking out my sort of 50 pence each way, which my mum would go and put on at the bookies. And I don't think I ever bagged a winner until number 6 Valverde, and by which point I was maybe 18 then or something like that. So fairly long time waiting for that first winner, but I had a tenner on. I think it came in at 12 or 14 to 1, and won 120, 140 pounds. And I was, from that moment, I sort of went from being someone who enjoyed racing once a year to being someone who suddenly started becoming aware of the endless sort of complexities and excitement that came with the sport. And from there, I sort of got into the rest of jumps racing, and not too long after that, or around that time, is also when Quarto Star came to prominence. And I was at university when he was in his pomp, and I was his biggest fan, sort of backed him to stupid degree every time he ran, and was just absolutely in love with the horse, you know, carried around sort of newspaper clippings in my wallet and everything. And so number 6 Valverde and then Quarto Star were the two horses which really sort of launched my interest in racing.
So then did you train to be a journalist, and then you just and then focused on the Racing Post? Is that how it worked?
Pretty much. I didn't study journalism, but I did sort of get involved in student journalism. I actually did a lot of music journalism rather than sports journalism, which is not too glamorous at the university level. It's mainly sort of going down to watch the field hockey team at 7 a.m. in the morning, whereas I went to see, you know, Franz Ferdinand playing to 200 people. But by the time I got to the end of my university time at university, I was absolutely sure I wanted to go into journalism. And basically, I was very fortunate to come across the BHA Dura graduate scheme. And through that, I could get a placement at the PA or the Racing Post, and I thought, what an opportunity this to combine two things that I really enjoy, racing and journalism. And was fortunate enough to get on the course, and did my placement at the PA in Howden, which is near Hull. And after that, came down to London, managed to get a spot at the Racing Post as a work experience sort of flunky, and the rest is history.
So how long ago was that?
That was 9 years ago. 9 years ago, I came down to London.
So one of the articles that, you know, caused a fair bit of debate was your article about Kempton Park being a travesty closing. When you look back at that article, was that correct? And do you still think it is now? Or was it just a way to play to the crowd and sort of make your name a bit, when really the track is totally gone?
Well, first of all, I mean, to take the simple fact that they're talking about closing a sports venue which is valued, and it might only be seriously valued once a year, but it's still got a real important place in the sort of cultural, historical, sporting heritage of racing with the King George. And I think anytime developers sort of get their claws into something like that and they want to shut it down in order to make a big whopping profit by building more identical houses, I think that's very sad. And I think we've seen that, you know, across society, whether it's sporting venues, whether it's music, cultural, you know, we're seeing all the places which make communities unique, which are valuable to people, shutting down and being replaced by houses, by things which don't really add any sort of complexity or value to people's lives. And I think that's really sad, and I think it's beholden on anyone who cares about these places to stand up and say, no, this is the wrong thing to do. Whether Kempton itself, is it failing right now? I think without doubt Kempton is one of the most underutilized racecourses in British racing. You know, they put on countless low-grade all-weather meetings, and they put them on for paltry crowds, and it can often be quite sort of grim when you're there, and that's a real shame, because Kempton is a hugely valuable resource. It's a great race course. It's 50 minutes from central London, and in 10 or 15 years when they build Crossrail 2, it could be as little as 20-25 minutes. So, you know, it's a huge resource. You've got millions and millions of people in the sort of catchment area. So I think the bigger question is, why has British Racing not made more of this resource? What can it do to build on this fantastic racecourse that we have there and make a real success of it, rather than saying, what can we do? You know, let's sell it now, let's bank a couple of hundred million, which will be gone in 10 years' time, and what will we have to show for it then? One fewer racecourse and the King George not at its proper home.
So would you be of the opinion that the current Jockey Club really is out of their remit to sell off something they've inherited and should be bequeathing to the future racing generations?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I'm a great believer in the idea that people who are in politics or in business often feel they have to do something because they have to justify their presence, and they love big projects, whether it's the government taking on big legislation or businesses selling off things so they can have money to play with. People at the top of organisations love being busy. They love having stuff to do. And I think this is a classic example of it. They've had a developer come along and say, we can give you so much money for this, we can give you hundreds of millions, think what you could do with all that money. And I think they've been blinded by it, frankly, rather than thinking about, you know, what's best for racing, what's best for racing fans, what's best for the King George, one of our very, very best races, and one that's absolutely has a treasured place in the sort of sporting calendar of this nation.
Okay, right. So we talked earlier, before we did this interview, about while working at the Racing Post, now, and we talked about social media. Now, people are very vocal on social media about a number of things, and one of them is that the Racing Post as a paper is neutered because it has to keep its advertisers happy, namely big bookmakers. Now, how far from that is the truth?
Well, I can only speak personally in terms of what I write about and what I'm asked to do. And whether people believe it or not, I can't help. But I've never been told, you can write this, by my editor. I've never been told you need to go and write favourably about this part of the business or this company. I think, like any business, the Racing Post cannot go out and set itself up as an antagonist, as a pure antagonist. I think, you know, what we always see ourselves as is a sort of critical friend. You know, we'll, whether it's the bookmaking industry or racing itself, you know, we're not there to be a cheerleader, we're not there to be a critic either. We're there to support when appropriate and to ask critical questions when appropriate. And I think that's quite a responsible thing to do. But obviously the consequence of that is you're never going to please everyone, because, you know, for every person who wants you to be more supportive of the racing industry, and we've had plenty of critics on that front, it's not there's other people who want you to go out and say, you know, why aren't you calling attention to this supposedly corrupt practice? So there's always a balance to be struck, and I don't think anyone at the Racing Post would ever claim that we get it right all the time, but we certainly strive to get it right. And I know personally, and from speaking to my colleagues, that everyone there has the right interests at heart, and that is, you know, to be good journalists writing pertinent and valuable articles.
So I think you've already answered the question, your previous answer, but have you ever pitched a feature that has been vetoed because of who it might upset?
I've only had one thing that was ever spiked, and it was a column about Ramzan Kadyrov, the Chechen warlord, who's a nasty piece of work, let me tell you. And the reason it was spiked is because I was sort of railing against his involvement in racing, but at the time he wasn't actually, didn't actually have any horses in Britain. I think he had a few out in Dubai and stuff. So the point was made that it was perhaps not entirely relevant. But I've still got that column up my sleeve, and if Mr. Kadyrov ever comes back to British racing, he's going to get both barrels.
I was thinking more along the lines of bookies, not a Chechen warlord. It's a fair play. Have you ever been asked to write an article championing something that you were morally opposed to?
No, I've not. I've been asked to write articles about things which I have personal views on. I remember one of the first things that I did many years back, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, we did a pullout looking at an anniversary of the liberalisation of betting shops, and one of the things that one of the areas we focused on was FOBTs, because obviously since their introduction they had revolutionised the bookmaking industry and completely changed the sort of culture of betting shops. So I went along. I wasn't told what angle to take. I was just asked to go along to a betting shop and to play the FOBTs, frankly, for a day, to learn a little bit about the background and to the controversies around them. And, you know, I was fairly junior in my journalism career then, and I certainly don't suggest that the piece I wrote was a stinging rebuke, but I came back and I wrote a piece which basically described FOBTs as random number generators, and talking about how it was quite sad in a way that people would sit there feeding money into them and potentially losing large sums of money about what was essentially just a computer terminal picking up a number from some warehouse somewhere. So I don't think, you know, that would be construed as any way a positive piece about FOBTs. And there was no issue with it. There was no issue whatsoever. I wasn't asked to go and, you know, paint a slightly more cheery picture of what these machines are. I've always been sort of given my head and allowed to write what I believe in, and, you know, I've always appreciated that.
Did you end up with a few quid or not?
Do you know, I actually did make some money, and it's the one and only time I've ever played FOBTs and I actually made money.
Okay, Tom, you've talked on it a bit in part one, but you shocked some people recently with a piece you wrote about the fixed odd betting terminals. Straight away, people were on social media saying that the Racing Post and you have been hypocritical, slating them when you've been actively promoting them in the past. Now, I'm not sure whether the Racing Post has actively promoted FOBTs in the past. Maybe you want to talk about that, and also, has the Post had a change of heart if they indeed had?
Well, to address the first part of whether we've supported FOBTs in the past, I think some of the criticism we've received over this subject has been unfair, because people have taken issue with the Racing Post running news stories reporting other people's warnings about FOBTs. For example, when the betting industry is warned that the results of sweeping restrictions on FOBTs would be catastrophic for racing, we've been lambasted. When people in racing have raised the same concerns, you know, and we've had betting racing industry executives estimating the loss in terms of income to British racing at £40 to £60 million a year. So we've reported that, and people have had a go at us for that. Now, I think you cannot possibly accuse the Racing Post of supporting FOBTs, because it has raised legitimate issues about what their shackling will mean for the betting industry and for racing. It's our job as a newspaper to report the news, and I think there's always been an element of shooting the messenger there. People don't want to hear that side of the argument, and therefore they've decided that by giving it a platform of any description, the Racing Post is in favour of Fopties. I dispute that. I don't think the Racing Post is in favour of Fopties. In terms of whether we've been as critical of Fopties as other publications and as some people would want, I'd accept that we've not been. And perhaps that was something which now we can revisit. In terms of my piece, it was a sort of an industry-led news focus. So I was speaking to people within the industry, trying to trace the Fopties story in its totality from their origins in the late 90s, when a couple of bookmakers came up with these machines as a way to increase the number of betting opportunities in their shops, through to the modern day, when they're bringing in £1.8 billion a year for retail bookmakers, when punters are losing over £1,000 per head on the machines per year, and when they're being restricted by government because they've become politically toxic, associated with problem gambling, and now they're going to be restricted, and that's going to cost the betting industry dearly and the racing industry. So the piece that I've written is looking at how that came to pass, how Fopties became toxic, and how the betting industry mismanaged this product and the controversy around them. And what I think is important from that is there's lessons to be learned there for the gambling industry as a whole, because clearly the gambling industry has lost sight of public concerns about what sort of products they have and how those products are pitched and how people interact with them and how they can lose money and at what pace they can lose money. And I think it's really important that the industry understands those concerns, understands what society wants from a gambling industry and what they think is inappropriate. And clearly, Fopties crossed that line. And I don't think people in the gambling industry realised that quickly enough. I think it's very possible that we at the Racing Post did not realise it as quickly as we should have done. But what we're seeing now is a real reckoning in terms of society's attitudes towards betting, and I think it's important for the Racing Post to be contributing to that debate.
Do you feel that racing has lost a whole generation of potential lifelong racing fans because they've been directed to those machines rather than getting involved in, betting on horses?
It's an interesting question. I think from what I've seen is that there's not a lot of crossover between people who play machines and people who bet on horse racing. Now, obviously, you say if there weren't machines, maybe they would have gone to horse racing. That's a what if that we can't answer for certain. But I think it's more likely that generation would have gone to football betting if they weren't going to go to Fopties, or they would have gone online where they can bet whatever they want on online casinos. If we're looking at whether racing has lost out on customers, and particularly younger customers, I think there are far bigger issues than Fopties.
Okay, now another feature that you wrote which caused a lot of stink was the one on the whip. Do you want to go there?
Sure, absolutely, let's do it. Well, I mean, I wrote that piece because, as I discussed before, I think it's a journalist's job to ask difficult questions sometimes and to raise controversial subjects. Now, just in case people forget, the piece that I wrote didn't say racing must ban the whip because the whip is terrible and it's a welfare issue. The piece I wrote said that I believe at some point in the future racing will have no choice but to get rid of the whip. Now, I could be wrong there. I no way set myself up as Mystic Meg with a crystal ball predicting the future. I don't know what the future is going to bring. What I do know is we have ample social history which shows us that in terms of animal welfare, you see a steady progression towards people having higher and higher standards. And we can look at that in terms of animal welfare, in terms of zoos, in terms of circus animals, in terms of fox hunting being banned and coursing being restricted, in terms of food standards. We see a constant movement towards higher standards. And we also saw it in racing when in 2011 they introduced strict new whip rules. So what I was suggesting is that I think at some point in the future, racing will, in order to sort of satisfy society's expectations of a sport that uses animals, have to restrict or get rid of the whip, because society won't be willing to accept a sport which involves people hitting animals, whether or not it actually hurts them.
Were you prepared for the almost hysterical backlash against you personally for writing that?
No, frankly, no. It was the first time I've had a response like that. I got 1,500 tweets in 24 hours, which is about sort of 5 years worth of tweets normally. And I didn't get any death threats, but I did get a couple of people who expressed a preference that I was dead, which is sort of a lack of commitment, actually, to the to their sort of opposition. But it took me aback. It did take me aback. You know, I'm pretty thick-skinned. I can take that sort of stuff. But it really did sort of reveal to me just how sensitive some people were to what I thought was actually, first of all, legitimate debate, and second of all, something which concerns the rules of a sport. You know, we're not talking life and death here. I thought if people cannot respond in a, you know, in a calm and reasonable way to something which is about the rules of a sport, then, you know, we're in a bit of trouble there. And it sort of raised for me as well how toxic social media has made some debates, because I just got a tiny little flavour of it. But if you're out there as a jockey or a trainer or a politician or a campaigner or frankly any woman on social media, then you're going to get some incredible vitriol and some hysterical responses from people who are sort of incapable of arguing in a reasonable and civil manner, and I think that's quite worrying.
So is that something you've put out there now and you're just going to leave it out there, or is it something you're going to almost campaign actively against? Is it going to be your thing to try and make sure that comes to pass, at the whip is banned eventually?
No, not at all. And I wouldn't want to see it banned. I think it absolutely needs to remain for safety reasons. I think that's important to make that distinction. My piece was about the likelihood of racing being obliged to do this, and suggesting that it was more sensible for the sport to get ahead and do it on its own terms, rather than being forced to do it when society's values move against it. That is not a campaign I want to start. It's a columnist's job to inform, to make predictions, to start debates. But it's not a campaign. It's not something that I feel strongly about. It's not something which I personally feel is a necessity. I feel it's a debate that I started and people engaged with, some in very good faith and some pretty angrily. It will come again. You know, anyone who thinks that the whip is only something that's brought up by the Racing Post or Racing Post columnists is wrong. It's going to come again, and whether or not the Racing Post ever writes another word about it.
Amongst all that vitriol, did you get any support from members of the racing community, leading members?
I did not get many people agreeing with my piece, but what I did get is a lot of people whose opinions I respect engaging with the piece in the spirit it was meant, which was that they read my arguments, they respectfully disagreed with them, or thought that they thought that things were going to pan out in a different way. And I thought that was an important thing to me, because while there were some people who just were sort of furious at me, people whose opinions I respect generally sort of said, you know, I don't agree, but it's an interesting piece, and you know, you can't ask much more as a columnist than that.
Okay, Tom, I think it's pretty well everybody agrees that betting and horse racing, you know, there's very, very few people that are interested in one and not the other. Are you a punter?
Yep, I do punt. And before you ask, no, not particularly great at it. I'd say over the course of the year, I like to think I make a small profit, which probably means I make a small loss. I used to be a much bigger punter. I told you before about how Quarto Star got me into got me into the sport, and when he was in his pomp, I just every spare quid I had, I would just pile on quarter star, and I built up these huge anti-post positions. And the biggest one I ever built up was £2,000 for the Gold Cup, and it was the first time I actually went to Cheltenham as well. And I went down, and of course it was 2008 when he got thumped by Denman, and I lost £2,000, which was every penny I had in the world, and about every penny I'd had for the 6 months running up to that. So it was pot noodle. It wasn't even pot noodle actually. It was, you know, sort of Tesco own brand instant noodles for the next few months. And since then, my betting is a more modest and affordable level, but I certainly am a punt.
Now, I understand that you've got a few opinions about bookmakers and bookmakers' behaviour in general, and you can really let us have it, because we don't mind you giving bookmakers a hard time in these interviews.
Sure. Well, I think bookmakers are increasingly sort of beginning to recognise that perhaps they haven't behaved in the best way. I think there's been a lot of short-termism where bookmakers have been attempting to make as much money as possible with the introduction of things like FOBTs and really sort of trying to capture a mainstream market. And I think perhaps they've lost sight of what they traditionally did, which is take bets on sports. I don't think they're the total pariahs they're sometimes made out to be, but at the same time, I think that the sort of last decade or so has shown there's a fair bit to be desired in the way some bookmakers have conducted themselves. And I think now you're seeing that awareness sort of percolating through at the upper echelons of big bookmakers. You know, you're seeing the launch of campaigns around problem gambling and social responsibility, and also in terms of sort of terms and conditions online. They were censured last year for sort of some of the online bonuses that they've been offering out, which then sort of trap customers' money for a long time. And of course, there's the ongoing debate about taking bets and restricting accounts, which is you know, been a major sort of reputational blow for bookmakers.
Okay, so we accept that some punters, successful punters, even if they're not massively successful, have a job to get on. So would you think that the sort of bookmaker punter cat and mouse of 2018, where they might get their auntie to put the bet on, or you know, a friend or whatever, is that legitimate fair game? And once those bets are on, should they stand?
I think if you look at it from a purely legal standpoint, you can say, well, if you contravene the terms and conditions, then a company isn't entitled to say we're not going to pay out. But I think what people find unfair, and legitimately so, is that bookmakers, if the bet loses, they're not going to say, oh, you got around our terms and conditions, here's your money back, we shouldn't have accepted that bet. They're basically only saying, you know, we won't pay out if you win. That, or at least that's how it's perceived. And I think if that's the case, then certainly you can understand why people have an issue with that situation.
Okay, thank you. Now, issues, the wider racing game. What do you feel the biggest issue that faces racing at the moment is?
I think it's basically where the next generation is coming from, and sort of racecourse crowds. And I've written about this a few times, and I think if you look at racecourse crowds, you know, the industry is always trumpeting 6 million people going racing, which is fantastic. You know, it's the second biggest spectator sport in Britain. A huge, huge sort of interest in it across sort of society, which is fantastic. And you're seeing a lot of young people on racecourses as well. What I think is concerning is the number of people who are going racing without racing or betting being high on their list of priorities. There was a bit of research done by the Racecourse Association a couple of years back, which I think showed, you know, 2/3 of racegoers who were mainly going for the social side of racing. And it's great, you know, I mean, going racing is a fantastic day out. I've taken loads of friends there, and I don't think anyone's ever had a bad day. You have a few drinks, you have a few bets, maybe there's a band on, it's great fun. You know, there's a lot of drama, a lot of colour, a lot of excitement. What I think is concerning is whether racing is turning those social racegoers into fans of the sport, or people who want to bet on it regularly. Because unless it is, we're not going to have a sustainable sport, because a sport is funded by betting. It's not, and never can be, funded by racecourse attendance alone. It's simply not something that's going to add up unless they hike ticket prices up by two or three times what they currently are, and expect to see just as many people coming through the door. So racing's big issue is, how do we turn people who enjoy racing as a day out into people who watch it on TV, have a bet, follow the stars of the sport, and follow the horses, and read the form, and place bets? That's a big question.
Okay, so what would your ideal answer be?
If I knew that, I probably wouldn't be working for the Racing Post. I'd probably be snapped up by the BHA or Great British Racing to spearhead their strategy, because it is the sort of £200 million question, which has exercised people in racing for as long as I've known the sport. I think part of it has to be about making it just making it interesting. There's got to be, any successful sport makes people argue about things, it makes them argue about personalities and horses. You know, racing's got this advantage that it is a game which is literally based on opinions. And yet, as we've discussed already, I think sometimes when people have the sort of upset the apple cart in racing, people respond very negatively. I think that's a shame, because I think controversy, I think interesting stories are part of what makes a sport interesting. And, you know, if racing wants loads of people to be interested in it, we've got to encourage people to have strong opinions and to argue about them and get on social media and discuss things and, you know, make their own opinions.
We've mentioned upturning apple carts. There's nearly upturned trees behind you. But that leads me well on to the last question. Now, you're a young man, already a skilled journalist with a great future, one would anticipate. But will you better fulfil your potential in a sport that takes such immediate offence to having his feathers ruffled and the apple cart upturned? And is it likely you might sort of turn to something a little more mainstream as your career matures?
Well, I mean, I'd just say, everyone has complaints about, how people respond to, what they write. Every journalist might have their own issues, but racing has been fantastic. I mean, I've had the most amazing time working here, and it's taken me around the world and to amazing race courses. I go to Cheltenham Festival every year. I've met amazing people in the sport who follow the sport, and I've told some fantastic stories. And ultimately, as a journalist, what I want to do is to tell interesting stories. And racing has an unbelievable reserve of these stories. It's a sport which is absolutely awash with history, with tradition, with nuance. And for any sports writer, for any writer, to report on something like that is pretty much a dream. And I think that's why you've seen so many fantastic writers through the years covering racing. It's got such a rich history in terms of journalism as well as everything else. And I've barely scratched the surface, to be honest.
And do you feel print media, is there still a future for print media?
Well, that might be the bigger problem. I hope so. I definitely hope so. I mean, I love reading a newspaper, but I think realistically we're going to see digital becoming more and more important as the years roll by. And obviously that brings with it new challenges, not least about how do you make journalism pay. And that's something the entire media is grappling with. But, you know, as a journalist, my interest in that is making it work, and making it work in a way which preserves the values of journalism, which I care about, which is that you tell stories truthfully, you give the voice to people who wouldn't otherwise have a voice, you challenge authority when it's in the wrong, and I've got great hopes that we'll be able to do that long into the future.
Brilliant. Tom Kerr, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay, today I'm in London in the Racing Post offices with Tom Kerr once again, but this time we're in the editor's office. Thanks for agreeing to talk to us, Tom. Congratulations on becoming the editor of the Racing Post. When we last talked, probably at the end of the summer, did you see it coming?
No, I did not. At the time, Bruce had not announced his intention to step down. I don't think even he had decided to step down then. So as far as I was concerned, everything was staying as it was for the foreseeable future. So it was a bit of a shock when he said he was going to be leaving. And when I heard that, my first thought wasn't, I'm going to apply for his job. It was, oh, so Jesus, what happens now? And it was only after a bit of reflection I thought I'll give it a go. And I was, it was a bit of a surprise to get the job, to be honest. I certainly didn't set out thinking it was going to be me. The bookies agreed. I think I was as short as 12-1, but as big as 50-1 with Star Sports, which was, you know, frankly an insult. But it was clearly a bit of a surprise to the bookies and frankly to myself.
Okay, so you've sort of jumped into this now then. How is your life going to change with the new responsibility of being the helm of the daily, of the trade daily?
Sure, it's a big responsibility to my staff, to the sport, to the industry as a whole. You know, we've got an important job to do for our customers, providing accurate, fast, insightful information when they want it, where they want it, and that's basically a 365 day a year job. It's going to occupy a lot of time, a lot of thinking time, a lot of management time. So, under no illusions, it's a big job.
Is the pressure kicked in yet?
To a degree, yeah. You know, sleep has suffered somewhat. Not getting my 8 hours, I don't think, anymore. But mostly enjoying it, really. Actually, you know, it's there's a fantastic team here, and it's really exciting working with them on new ideas and thinking about things we could do to improve our coverage and make what we do bigger and better.
Kenny, when you were working on the Bruce, I'm pretty sure had a good relationship with him, but did you quietly shake your head and disagree with some of the things that he was doing?
Yeah, I got on really well with Bruce. And, you know, he's helping me out now. He's still there as someone to run ideas by, which I really appreciate. He's got an amazing experience in this game. 11 years as editor. I don't know how long he's been in newspapers, but much longer than that. So he is an expert. But of course, there are times when we disagree. There's things I'm going to do differently or see differently. We've all got different perspectives. But, you know, to be fair to Bruce, I don't think he ever expected or wanted a bunch of yes men around him. Like most editors, I think he valued and he appreciated when people said, no, I don't actually agree with that. So it wouldn't always have been a case of, say, or sort of like quietly shaking my head. You know, there were times when I sort of took a different line from him and we'd have a discussion and he'd challenge you to stand up your beliefs. And that's the sort of editor I want to be as well. I want my staff, my reporters, to feel empowered to come to me, to disagree with me, and then we can work out what the best course of action is.
Was there anything that he did that you disagreed with so much that you're going to now reverse that?
Nothing springing to mind, frankly, no. I mean, I think there's if anything, there's a few things where, you know, probably when I was not sat in this chair, it was easier to disagree with. But when you're in the position of making decisions, in the position of being accountable for decisions, they become more understandable. You know, everything has an equal and opposite reaction, and you need to be aware of the big picture. So sometimes it's you get a new perspective on things.
Right, so you see things differently sat in the chair you're in now as opposed to your previous.
To a degree, yeah. I mean, it doesn't change your sort of fundamental beliefs or values, but there's a degree of pragmatism that you need to apply to decisions, and, you know, that's just the nature of the job.
And have you got a main priority, number one on the list you need to tick off? What are you going to do?
Oof, it's a deceptively difficult question. I guess my main priority is to keep the standards high, to look at what we're doing digitally and how we can sort of kick that on to the next level. There's lots of opportunities there in terms of how we present stories, how we cover things, how we use our data. It's really exciting. And, you know, I want to make sure that my team of journalists are happy and engaged and enjoying their jobs.
And one of the things that people buy the racing posts for, they're looking for value, they're looking for best prices, they're looking to get the edge over the bookies, etc. When you look at the, I think the Telegraph is £1.80 and the Daily Mail 70p, and you're £2.90. Can you really say that the punters are getting value still?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're really good value because we, you know, we're a specialist newspaper. I think maybe a more apt comparison would be to look at the Financial Times, which is much closer to us. You know, specialist information carries higher costs because, you know, it's not for a mass market audience. The Times and the Telegraph have a potential audience of every single person who's interested in news in the United Kingdom. We have a potential audience of everyone who's interested in horse racing or betting in the United Kingdom and Ireland. It's a much smaller potential market. So for us to, you know, make a business that works, you know, we need to price ourselves as a specialist publication. Now that said, I think we're great value. You know, we've got, as our adverts say, we've got 200 experts working, analysing, reviewing races, investigating news stories, interviewing people. I think we produce some fantastic products, and I think it's good value.
And I think we touched on this last time, but is the Racing Post remaining in a print format imperative to it, the survival of the brand?
I think, any newspaper shutting is a really, really sad day. You saw The Independent a few years ago go from print to digital only, and I think it lost something as a consequence. Certainly the brand lost something. So I would be absolutely focused on ensuring that the print newspaper survives as long as possible. I personally, as a consumer, like newspapers, even though I use my phone or my laptop to get my news most of the time. I like sitting down with a newspaper. I like going to the races with a Racing Post. I think it gives a different experience, and I think a lot of our customers value that as well. And, you know, frankly, it's my job to ensure that we're selling enough copies of the paper every day to keep the paper going, and that's what I intend to do.
Okay, now you are obviously a newspaper, reporting the news and providing the form, etc. Do you think that the Racing Post should take on the big issues to the racing authorities and sort of, if you decide to champion a cause, you should follow it through? Is that part of your, how you think the paper should be?
Yeah, a champion a cause is perhaps a little bit different to what I'd see our responsibility. I think as a newspaper, we're there to challenge, we're there to investigate, we're there to shine a light on mistakes or wrongdoing, and that's going to mean challenging people who would prefer not to be challenged. You know, there's a old line about, you know, journalism being something that other people don't want published. Everything else is PR. You know, it's a good line, and that's the truth of it. We as journalists need to be willing to take on people, organisations, when we think people are making a mistake. And I think our readers expect that of us.
So as an editor, this is only just examples. If you decided as a newspaper that, right, it's time the whip was banned, or it's outrageous that they're thinking about closing Kempton Park, we should really fight. Would you make a decision and then take a stand, or are you going to just report what's happening, or do you think you're going to actually go for changing things as a paper?
I think there's times and occasions where the paper can take an editorial view and say, this is the right thing to do. You know, you gave two examples there, the whip and Kempton. You know, my view is that the first of those, the whip, I've written before that I think it will likely end up being restricted to use for encouragement, for safety only. And, you know, I believe that will be the case, and I think in the long term that will probably be for the best for racing. However, I recognise that a lot of people have different views on that, and they hold those views strongly. So it would be remiss of me to then say, well, my newspaper is going to take that stance regardless of what that my other journalists think. I just don't think that's fair or responsible. I think there's a debate to be had there, and I think it's important to have that debate. You also mentioned Kempton. Now, while I would happily allow one of my columnists or writers to write that they believe that it's a good idea to close Kempton and to take that money and invest it elsewhere, such as in Sandown, and Alistair Down, who's one of our top writers, does hold that view, God knows why. But I would be more than happy to put on the front page, you know, closing Kempton would be a terrible move, because I think that's first of all, I believe it very strongly. And second of all, I know that's a view held widely by racing fans and racing professionals. And I think especially when there's consensus around an issue and a lot of people feel strongly about it, you know, it can be beholden on us to sort of amplify those voices and use our influence for the benefit of the sport.
Okay, so under your leadership, in 12 months' time, do you see a noticeably different paper from when the last day that Bruce was in charge?
I think there's probably small things that people may or may not already be noticing. You know, there's changes that I've brought in, you know, in terms of how we're presenting stories, the use of data, you know, how we're doing front pages, etc. So there are changes, but it's an evolutionary process rather than a revolutionary process. I think if you laid them side by side, you'd definitely notice a difference. But I think for most of our readers, what they're interested in is the quality of our coverage. I believe we already do a good job. I want us to do an even better job. But hopefully readers will just simply go on enjoying what we do and appreciating what we do and remaining our readers of our publication.
Great stuff. Well, Tom Kerr, editor of the Racing Post, thank you very much.
No problem.
Look out for our regular money-back offers, including Pips at the Post on selected horse racing and Saved by the 90s for all Premier League and televised championship matches. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.